option. When you approach the podium and pick which one you want, the one in the middle does rise or can be lowered. Please indicate who you're speaking on behalf of as well as who you are for our record-keeping purposes. Before I have the case called, can you tell me the pronunciation of your client, is it Hassouné?
Hassouné.
Hassouné, okay, Hassouné, thank you. I'm going to ask then that our marshal call the next case for consideration by the court.
Now calling case number 822-0665, Hassouné Properties, LLC versus Beta M. Yassin.
And when you're ready, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Charlie Alden, and I represent the appellant Hassouné Properties in this matter. This matter involves review of a district court's written opinion where the district court served as the finder of fact in a trial that took place from October 25th through 28th and then concluded on November 22nd, 2021 in Dakota County. If you'd prefer that I don't go through a lot of the backstory that's in the brief, feel free to...
It's entirely up to you, but I can assure you the panel is well-versed as far as what the district court did or didn't do and the substance of the court trial.
Excellent. I think the briefs, from my perspective, cover the legal issue pretty well here. The most salient point, from my perspective, is that the district court issued its opinion on April 9th, 2022, about 2 weeks later, on April 22nd, 2022, I believe it was, the trial transcript was published. And from the trial transcript, it was manifestly clear that the district court had made clear error in its decision and that the factual basis for its decision was clearly erroneous. And here, as we mentioned in our brief, we use the phrase cut and paste, because that's exactly what the district court did. That's a somewhat heavy allegation to level against a district court judge.
Of course, the appellate court does remind the district court that they need to make their own independent findings, but that doesn't mean that it's reversible error if, in fact, the district court did make findings that were the same as what was submitted.
Well, yeah, I just think it's a relevant observation to make, just like the Hassouné family's history in providing all of the $450,000 down that went toward purchase of this strip mall in Inver Grove Heights, with the respondent, Beta Yassin, providing no consideration for purchase of this property, is also a relevant factual basis. But the point with regard to the cut and paste is that on April 22nd, when the transcript was published, it was clear that some of the things that the defendants had put in their proposed order were just completely contrary to the facts that were produced at trial. And the most important, of course...
Much like a jury trial, the finder of fact can either accept what's presented or disregard. If this was a jury trial, they could have done the same thing by disregarding your client's testimony or evidence, right?
Well, it wasn't that they as much that they disregarded my client's testimony or evidence. It's that the district court specifically said that it was relying on statements by three men, because remember, there was a notary. There was Beta Yassin's son, who at the time was 14 years old, who was living with his mother at the time, and who was testifying over video on his high school lunch break. No apparent incentive to manipulate the facts, provided a very detailed accounting of what happened on September 22nd.
There was competing evidence. We had respondent in this case who says, I wasn't there, I was off shopping, and in fact produced evidence that she'd been at, I can't remember where, DSW, a couple of stores, and had a receipt that was submitted that showed the timestamp on that. I mean, that's competing evidence. So you pick what you believe and what you don't. I mean, how do we get around that, including the district court's explicit determination that she was credible?
Well, it's not really competing evidence, respectfully, because the district court's considered it to be competing evidence because it miscited the testimony of...
She also testified that she did not sign the document.
Right, but three witnesses, including her own son, said that she did, and she was...
And the district court found that testimony credible. And as I'm sure you're aware, we defer to the district court's credibility determinations. We don't make our own credibility determinations and we don't reweigh the evidence. So given that, it seems to me that you are asking us to reweigh the evidence. Help me out here. Given that we defer to the district court's credibility determinations, how can we find the finding that she didn't sign the documents to be clearly erroneous?
Well, I think first of all, you look at the factual findings in the district court order and determine whether there's any of the factual findings are clearly erroneous. And the factual finding that the district court made, that three men testified that the signing happened exactly at 2 p.m. because one of them looked at his watch, which is in,
It concluded that the child testified, right, that the son testified that he looked at his watch.
That's what the district court concluded.
And what I think the testimony was is that the son recalled the date because he looked at his phone.
Correct.
Okay. Most people like check the time actually now by looking at their phones. I mean, it might have said watch, but he went on to testify. It was in the afternoon. It was around 2, et cetera. I'm having trouble finding why that is just such a meaningful error. Because she said she wasn't there. District court believed her. And the district court said, okay, yeah, it was 2 o'clock because he looked at his watch. But really, he looked at his phone, which would also show his time. And he said it was around 2.
So that's an argument that the defendants have made that, well, he looked at his phone, not his watch. But if you look at the trial testimony, this is on page 60 of the transcript. He says he remembered the date as being September 22nd, not the time as being 2 p.m. And I think these distinctions matter because
he testified the time was around 2 p.m.
He testified that it was around 2 p.m. after being led to that conclusion.
Well, asked.
Sure. But what I was endeavoring to state earlier is that, is there a fact in the district court order or are there facts that are clearly erroneous? Yes. The district court said that three men testified that the signature occurred exactly at 2 p.m. And then from there, the district court said, well, this conflicts with the famous footwear receipt. So what if nobody had testified that the signature happened exactly at 2 p.m.? Then we would be in a situation where Beda Yassin admits to going to Jamal Hassouneh's house to drop her children off for a month, and there's no conflict with any of the testimony of the three other witnesses who said that they saw her sign the quit claim.
There is conflict because she testified that she did not sign the quit claim deed.
Okay, so I'm going to...
And I guess that's where I'm having trouble. The district court found her credible, and it's not our role to remake a credibility or redo a credibility determination.
I think the issue is if I've yet to finish the sort of two-part statement that I was intending to make, which is number one, are there findings of fact that are clearly erroneous? And I think, you know, from my perspective, the 2 p.m. thing is clearly erroneous. Not only in that the son did not testify that he remembered it specifically or precisely because he looked at his watch. His testimony doesn't say anything about that. But the second point is, was that harmful error? And from my perspective, in the district court's own words, and it's at page 12, paragraph 6 of the order, the district court says, the court found defendant Beda's testimony on the issue more credible. The court was presented with tangible physical evidence that strongly supported her testimony. At the same time, this evidence shattered the validity of plaintiff's witness's testimony on the topic. And that's my contention here, is that we, on the one hand, have facts that are clearly erroneous. On the other hand, we have the district court saying, this is what I based my decision on, right? Because the court says at paragraph 6 on page 12 of its order under the conclusions of law, it says, this evidence, meaning this famous footwear receipt from 203, shattered the validity of plaintiff's witness's testimony on the topic. So that's the point at which I'm saying this is harmful error. This is not harmless error. And it's not about...
Well, but, I mean, that conclusion finds defendant Beda's testimony more credible, also supported by physical evidence, and at the same time that evidence shattered the validity of the witness's testimony. Two of the witnesses said it was in the afternoon. I think that she testified she was not there in the afternoon. Is that correct?
I think her testimony said that she's, all she said is it was darker out.
Yeah, okay.
That's all she said.
Okay.
Well, and she had receipts ranging from, I don't remember the exact times, but it was more than just 2 o'clock. There was one that was like 3:47, and so it was a range of time in the afternoon.
Yeah, I understand from 3:25, from 2:03 to 3:25 when she was shopping at Famous Footwear, somewhere else, and then Walmart. But
so the one error that I think that you focused on isn't the other witnesses. I don't know where the district court. What they said the time was, if they said the afternoon or just the time, or the time. But it's just, the son said it was around 2, and then the district court, the error that you find is that he knows that because he looked at his watch. And that's the error. But that, I don't know, I'm not sure how that's not harmless error, given other testimony it was the afternoon, her testimony it was not. And then, of course, on top of it, the testimony that she did not go in the house, she did not sign a deed, et cetera.
Right.
I don't know that it all crumbles.
What's that?
Your theory is it all crumbles on the watch.
I'm going off of what the district court said. I mean, and I'm looking at the standard of review. Were factual findings clearly erroneous, and was it harmful error? So I think it's, we've got an odd situation because...
You have a factual finding, and I've got the order in front of me, but I'm not going to go with specificity. We do have a factual finding that... Your team went to the recorder's office to record the purported deed, and the transferee, Hassanish, I'm sorry, Properties LLC, hadn't even been formed yet. I mean, what do we do about that?
Oh, the
beta? I mean, you can't transfer property to a non-existing entity. If we believed your theory that it was in fact a valid deed, there wasn't anything to transfer it to.
Well, I think that you can do business as an LLC prior to formally setting up the LLC, but I don't know that that's my perspective on the district court's order was that, again, I'm going to what the district court order said in terms of why it based its decision the way it did. And
well, that's what I'm getting at is this all comes to the credibility decisions of the district court. And as Judge Cochran indicated, the toughest thing you have with your case is asking us to reweigh the evidence because that's not before us. I don't have any of the parties. We don't have any of the parties. What we look at is the district court's determination. So my next question is this. I look at this and I keep coming back to the fact that there isn't any determination made at this point as far as a division of this property. I mean, they aren't divorced. There's nothing that's happened. Nobody knows if it's marital or non-marital. And the entire issue has to do with this purported quitclaim deed.
Mm-hmm.
So if the district court says she's telling the truth and they lied, what are we supposed to do with that? I mean, doesn't that put it back to where it was? We're not saying she's the owner of the property. We're not saying that she used her funds to purchase the property. We're not saying that she's entitled to the exclusive use of the property. We're just saying it's back to where it was. Let family court step in and decide the respective interests.
Well, they do have an ongoing marital dissolution situation going on, which was commenced a long time ago. I'm not representing Abed Hassune in that matter, but of course the same point could have been made during, at the inception of this case. I didn't represent.
I guess, Mike, I didn't have a very artful question. I guess what I'm saying is, how can we say, Judge Meyer, you were wrong. She wasn't telling the truth. We're not empowered to do that as an appellate court. We're a reviewing court. So tell us how we can say that, because what you want us to do, I'm assuming, is to send it back, or better yet, to just say, no, the deed is accurate, and that's where the title goes.
Yeah, that is what I would like.
So we're supposed to tell Judge Meyer that his conclusion that the Beta LLC, that she really was lying. How do we do that?
I've never seen
it happen.
Right, but I think it's a matter of relying on the standard of review, which is, are there facts in the order that are clearly erroneous?
And he says, she's telling the truth, and they are conjuring up facts. That's
not the way I look at it. I mean, Judge Mayer adopted the defendant's proposed order wholesale, but in that proposed order, it said, among other things, three men testified that it happened exactly at 3 p.m.
Could have been 15 men. Doesn't matter.
What's that?
Is that in the findings that three men testified it was exactly at 2 p.m.? I don't remember seeing that in the findings. What finding is that?
I'll see if I can.
I thought that there was a finding with respect to the son.
Let me find. Hang on a second.
I mean, it's still like, again, I don't know. I mean, I would think what Judge Werke is, even if that were a problem, the suggestion that means that the court still wouldn't say, oh, I think that she is more credible than they. I mean.
At number 49, it references the parties you're speaking of. But you are out of time, but you'll be able to answer that question when you.
I have 5 minutes of rebuttal, I think, right? Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew Skopp, and I represent the respondents, Beta Yassin and Beta LLC. I think it's important to note that this was a multi-day trial where the district court judge had an opportunity to see these witnesses, watch them testify, evaluate their credibility. I think it's also worth noting that this is a very unusual civil case. It's not very often that a judge is faced with a deed, a quitclaim deed, and there is an allegation that it was forged. All of the facts that you see in the findings of fact and the conclusions of law, you know, they're attacked in the appellant's brief as somewhat irrelevant or extraneous, but I think a lot of those facts get to the idea that this is a patriarchal system, that the men in the family essentially answered to Ali, the father, and Abed, Imad, and Ali, the son, all did what Ali suggested they should do, which is essentially lie at the trial. The district court judge, in no uncertain terms, decided, after evaluating the credibility of these witnesses, that they were lying and Beta was telling the truth. That is a critical determination by a district court judge who sat and listened to witness after witness after witness testify in ways that they had prepared themselves to testify. They were prepared to falsely testify, and there is evidence not just in the watch or the phone or 2 p.m. or receipts. There is other evidence in this case that the district court clearly called out as raising serious questions about the credibility of these men as they testified. We have inconsistencies in the record that are consistent with lying by these male witnesses. One of the things I think is most interesting in reading the district court's order is sort of this nugget that wasn't mentioned at all in the argument we just heard, is this binding contract agreement. You would think that as the plaintiff in a case like this, you would have pulled out this binding contract agreement and you would have repeatedly hit on the points and the obligations that Beta had under this binding contract agreement. But what happened is the plaintiff never put the agreement into the record, almost as if the lawyer was concerned that the agreement was not legitimate. It was the defendants who put the agreement into the record to show that this agreement was a forgery, just like the quitclaim deed was a forgery. Beta testified that she did not sign the binding contract agreement, and Jamal testified that he did not recall signing it. So you have two individuals, both who say they didn't sign this agreement. Now, that's not the quitclaim deed, but it goes to the character and the credibility of these witnesses who were basically orchestrating a scheme to take back property that they thought was that they should be entitled to or that Ali, as the patriarch, should be entitled to.
Would you agree that in this proceeding, Beta had the burden to show that to prove forgery by clear and convincing evidence?
Yes, I think the presumption is that the document is legitimate, and she clearly did that. I think when you evaluate the witness testimony and you say to yourself as the judge, this witness is lying through his teeth, it's a lie not just in his testimony, but I see these other documents that were forgeries. The binding contract agreement was made up after the fact. That's why it's so consistent with the facts as they sort of played out, because it was backdated and made up after the fact. But if you look at that testimony, the credibility determinations are extremely important to that clear and convincing evidence standard. But ultimately, the court's determinations are entitled to deference because they are based on reasonable evidence. It's not just the 2 p.m. It's not just the phone. And I think if you look at the testimony of Ali, the son, he appears, and I think this is consistent with the record as a whole, he was coached to say multiple times that he had looked at his phone, he had looked at his phone, he had looked at his phone. It's almost like he went out of his way to repeatedly say he had looked at his phone so that he could confirm that the date was September 22. It's not outside the realm of reasonable to think that Judge Mayer, as he listened to this testimony, thought to himself, there is a coordinated conspiracy to lie about this deed and to try to take this property from Beta LLC. I think it's important, Your Honors, too, to understand this is about a quitclaim deed, and if this was a forgery, which the court determined it was, the only thing this does is essentially maintains the status quo. Beta LLC, it has only one member, and that is Beta Yassin. This property is owned by an entity, and it was not transferred by Beta LLC or Beta Yassin. So the important thing to note is there's a lot of discussion about, you know, there's equitable arguments being made about generational wealth, or why would Ali, the father, allow his generational wealth to be lost to essentially his daughter-in-law. That is a false assumption, because there is not evidence in the record that there was generational wealth in this strip mall. That was a disputed fact, and the court clearly did not agree with those facts as they're sort of presented in the appellant's brief. There's also very unusual facts that seem inconsistent with and incompatible with the theory that this deed was not forged. And so, on the whole, Your Honors, we ask that this court look at the district court's decision, the findings of fact, and determine that this, whether it was a watch or a phone, that's harmless error. That's not a critical difference or distinction in this case. And the court's determination that this discussion about Ali, the son, saying that this happened at 2 p.m., that too is supported by the testimony, and the court clearly could have concluded that this alleged meeting, which never happened, was testified to as happening at 2 p.m., and there was a receipt for Famous Footwear in Apple Valley that was around the same time, within minutes of that supposed meeting. And looking at Beta's testimony and sort of her shock that the bank is now saying you're in default because somebody recorded a quitclaim deed, all of those facts go to the conclusion that Beta was telling the truth. She did not intend to sign a quitclaim deed. She did not sign a quitclaim deed. And essentially, these individuals, Abed's criminal history is documented and is discussed in the findings of fact. They schemed to do exactly what Abed wrote on the walls of the strip mall. He wanted to get revenge. He wanted to take it out on Beta, and they came up with this plan and scheme to do that. Fortunately, Judge Mayer saw through it. It didn't work. The credibility determinations were key to his conclusions, and this court should affirm his decision in its entirety because it was the right decision for the defendants. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Alden, you get the last word.
Okay. I'd just like to respond to a few of the points that that opposing counsel made. First of all, regarding the argument that this would just be maintaining the status quo where there's a family law case going on, this property was sold by Beta Yassin in, I think it was September of last year, notwithstanding the fact that the appellants had a Liz Pendens on the property. So that ship has sailed in terms of maintaining the status quo. Regarding my friend's comments about the additional evidence in the record about, as he mentioned, criminal history, so on and so forth, I see all that from a different perspective, which comes as no surprise. But from my perspective, that's just further evidence that the judge wasn't focusing on the validity of the quitclaim deed and the signature. Because, and I mentioned in the brief, you know, that there was extensive questioning during trial about whether, for instance, Abed Asune should be questioned about his marijuana use, because does marijuana use cause brain damage and things like that. There's a lot of stuff that was very superfluous, and I find a lot of superfluous material in the defendant's proposed order, which was adopted by the district court. And I think that from my perspective, that provides context in terms of further showing that the district court was not weighing the evidence properly and was not giving the now appellants a fair shake. But again, I go back to the standard of review, because I think that that is what primarily supports our claim here as the appellants, which is the same question I mentioned earlier. Was there, were there findings of fact that were clearly erroneous? I think that they were, that there were, I'm sorry. And then was that error harmful? And here, I just go back to what the judge actually said, not speculation about what the judge might have been thinking because of the evidence in the record, but what the judge actually said, which is at paragraph 6 on page 12 of the order, where he says that this erroneous factual finding about somebody having not only the kid looking at his watch and seeing it was 2 p.m., that's not true, but that all three men testified that it happened around 2 p.m. And again, to your point, Judge Smith, about, well, if it was in the afternoon and it was light out and they're all sort of saying that, doesn't that sort of convey the same thing? I just wanted to mention, because I think I was kind of getting around to it when my time expired last, but so the notary, if you look at the transcript, page 53, he said, I really can't give an exact time. I mean, this is from like over 2 years ago. And the dad just testified that he remembered seeing her sign it. He didn't testify about it being in the afternoon. So the only piece of evidence that puts this in the afternoon is this suggestion by defense counsel to the son that it was around 2 p.m. And let's be reasonable. I think we know why defense counsel was asking that, because defense counsel had this 203 receipt, which he considered to be the smoking gun. And I don't think Mr. Schopp was trial counsel. I'm not suggesting that that's what he was doing. He wasn't trial counsel.
Neither of you were trial counsel,
right?
Were you?
Right. Correct. Yep. But in any case, that is what I sort of keep coming down to, because I really, from my perspective, it looks like the judge went out of his way to not evaluate things fairly for the appellants, not only because of all the superfluous material that's in the record that has nothing to do with whether the quitclaim deed was signed, nothing whatsoever, but also because the judge manufactured testimony. From my perspective, it was clear error, because when the transcript came out 13 days after the judge issued his order, the transcript eviscerated the conclusion, the findings of fact that the judge was explicitly relying on to, quote, shatter the validity of plaintiff's witnesses' credibility on the topic. So that is the way I see it. And of course, I understand that the standard of review on appeal from a district court's factual determinations is a high one. But when the district court, I think that that's what the defendants have going for them, is this high standard of review. But with my time expiring, when I look at this and I say, well, what is the standard? Are there clearly erroneous findings? And then did the district court rely on them? And that's exactly what happened, and the district court got caught when the transcript came out on the 22nd of April. Thank you for your time.
Thank you to both of you for appearing today and arguing in support of your client's cause. The matter is submitted, which means a decision will be issued in the statutory time frame. And also be careful driving when you leave.
Thank you.